a highly trained federal force. The only rhetorical flourish the Times avoided was to call private sector workers shiftless. When was the last time you heard someone say, "The help here is way too slow and incompetent. Why don't they hire some civil service people?" Far be it from me to defend airport security personnel, but making them government employees, I assure you, will not improve matters. We're not going to call out the Marines to rifle through little old ladies' handbags before they board flights to Cleveland. This is Hillary care for the airports. The reason airports already resemble the torture chambers in Orwell's 1984 is that they are natural monopolies. If you live in Chicago, you can't decide you really prefer to fly out of Dallas because you like the airport better. You're stuck in Chicago, and O'Hare knows you're stuck with Chicago airports. There is no other explanation for why there even is an airport in Chicago. Planes are only allowed to fly in or out of O'Hare for approximately 20 minutes every week. The absence of competition among airports leads to phenomenally stupid inconveniences that would be unfathomable in a competitive environment. Only a monopoly would ban the world's most popular soft drink, Coca-Cola, from being sold on its premises, or sell a tasteless tuna salad sandwich for about what you'd pay for a Kobe beefsteak dinner in Tokyo. Only a monopoly would have bathrooms that still employ those ridiculous Potemkin hand dryers in lieu of something that might possibly dry your hands, like, say, paper towels. Only a monopoly could force people to stand in two-hour lines in order to answer phenomenally stupid questions with a straight face or risk being denied service. Natural monopolies everywhere adopt a philosophy on customer service best summed up with the words, take it or leave it. The liberals' solution to a monopoly is invariably to create an even bigger monopoly by turning it over to the federal government. Not surprisingly, the only experiences nearly as unpleasant as commercial air travel are those enterprises run by the government. If you had to get up tomorrow morning and get a driver's license or a lamp, which would you dread more? At least, natural monopolies only lead to bathrooms with no paper towels. Government monopolies have been known to lead to the Khmer Rouge. The only effective solution to a natural monopoly is for the government to create artificial competition by setting standards. Off the top of my head, for example, no box cutters on airplanes, and fining airports that fail random spot checks. In other words, conform to these national standards, or we'll penalize you monetarily. We could call it the No Airport Left Behind Act. Even for major criminal offenses like cigarette smoking in Los Angeles bars, the government doesn't send in a government worker to tend bar. It fines bars that fail to comply with the law. Moreover, I wish the security guards luck, but keeping weapons off planes is not the linchpin to safe skies anyway. It better not be. We can't keep weapons out of prisons. We certainly can't keep them off airplanes. The airport shakedowns do, however, comply with the government's primary criterion for airport safety, which is that all travelers be inconvenienced with absolutely no increase in airline safety. Thus, one of the FAA's recent safety innovations is to demand photo IDs from passengers at various checkpoints throughout the airport. For maximum annoyance, this includes the moment at which you are about to board the plane, when you are balancing carry-on luggage, a newspaper, and a Starbucks coffee, and clenching a boarding pass between your teeth. Studies have shown that demanding photo ID is a highly effective method of keeping vampires off airplanes. There's only one small flaw in the photo ID requirement. There is absolutely no reason to imagine terrorists don't have photo IDs. Indeed, the 9/11 terrorists not only had ID cards, but blessed their ID cards. Instruction number 12 of the terrorists' pre-attack manual was, "Bless your ID, your passport, and all of your papers." The instructions give another clue to the hijacker's state of mind that, in the hands of creative safety professionals, might lead to a practical safety check. Instruction number 1 was to put on cologne. Instruction number 2 was to shower. See, it doesn't work if you put on cologne and then take the shower. Instruction number 3, For a definition of the word shower, consult the glossary. If the government demanded results, airports wouldn't have time to engage in man's truly oldest profession, oppressing his fellow man. Instead, this natural monopoly would finally be forced to stop harassing passengers for the fun of it and to adopt safety procedures that would have the novel attribute of making planes safe. The New Roman Arena, Airports, November 22, 2001. If the airlines had hired the most expensive consultants in the country to help them figure out a way to make the flying experience even more unpleasant than it was before September 11th, the consultants would have given up in despair. But chalk one up to American ingenuity. The airlines have done it on their own. Getting a head start on the holiday season, airport security guards have already begun their Christmas shopping by stealing travelers' belongings. Unless they pilfer possessions worth more to you than making your plane and getting to wherever you are going, there's nothing you can do. And the guards know there's nothing you can do, which adds to the innate charm of airport security personnel. A security guard took a piece of my jewelry at the Spokane airport last Saturday with approval from his Olympic security supervisor. The alert supervisor called airport police when I asked for her name. I want it back. It was a silver charm from Aspen in the shape of a bullet with a great deal of sentimental value. But in a strange coincidence, a few hours later it was missing from the Olympic security box of confiscated loot. It's probably already wrapped. I'm now carrying gift certificates from Zales in my carry-on bag just to save the guards time during the busy holiday season. If you are not a half-wit and not Christmas shopping from other people's stuff, you will instantly recognize that a silver charm is a silver charm, and it doesn't matter if it's in the shape of the anthrax virus. Even a real bullet can't cause any harm without a gun. A silver charm soldered to a keychain is less threatening than a tube of lipstick. Of course, my lipstick would undoubtedly also have been deemed a grave security risk by Olympic security if it had been in the supervisor's color. Since September 11th alone, that silver charm keychain has been through airport security dozens of times. But security guards are on high alert. There are only 29 more shopping days till Christmas. There has been more caterwauling about the Bureau of Prisons listening to the conversations of prison inmates suspected of plotting terrorist attacks on America than to the universal physical inspections of Americans trying to board airplanes. If law enforcement officers ever dared paw through the belongings of an Egyptian immigrant named Mustafa with the fascistic intensity of airport security patting down little old ladies suspected of flying to Iowa, liberals would explode in righteous indignation. As long as the airlines insist on going through the manifestly absurd exercise of treating all passengers alike in some obscure desire to impress the New York Times editorial page, they ought to abandon the personal inspections altogether. It's absurd to imagine that personal inspections are going to keep weapons off airplanes. Even by turning airports into the pleasant and welcoming environment of a federal penitentiary, you'd keep more weapons off planes just by banning Christian Slater from commercial air travel. After airport security confiscates any jewelry that might make a nice Christmas gift, the airlines hand out weapons on the planes. They still serve wine in glass goblets that can be smashed to create jagged glass daggers. They serve soda in cans that can be twisted apart to create razor-sharp knives. Not to worry, though. If you think about it for up to 3 seconds, it will occur to you that terrorists don't want to knife a few passengers. If terrorists just wanted to kill a bunch of people in one place, they could go to shopping malls, restaurants, movie theaters, anywhere, really. So why aren't there security guards at the Cineplex pawing through our purses and stealing our jewelry? Airports are attractive to terrorists for one reason. There are airplanes at airports. And what is alluring about airplanes is that they can be turned into cruise missiles or blown up in the air. The only safety precaution that will make the plane safer would be impenetrable cockpit doors and bomb checks for all cargo. two security measures airlines doggedly refused to implement. While still completely vulnerable to another terrorist attack, Americans submit like good Germans to these purposeless airport shakedowns, which are about as useful as those National Guardsmen hanging around in airports right after 9/11 carrying unloaded rifles. Most sickening is the relish other Americans are taking in their new roles as fascist stormtroopers. In a famous study conducted at Yale in the 60s by Professor Stanley Milgram, members of the public willingly administered what they thought were fatal electric shocks to another human being, simply because they were told to do so by an authority figure. Believing they were participating in a study on memory, the volunteers watched a pupil being strapped to a chair and wired with electrodes. The volunteers were then taken to an adjacent room where they were told to read questions to the pupil and to administer increasingly powerful electric shocks for every incorrect answer. The electric shock buttons seemed to go up to one, administering a jolt of 450 volts on a button labeled Danger, Severe Shock. As the shocks were administered, the mock pupils acted as if they were being subjected to increasingly greater pain. Even as the pupils writhed and screamed in pain, the volunteers readily administered the shocks. Finally, the pupil would emit a blood-curdling scream and then suddenly fall totally silent, apparently dead. Two-thirds of the volunteers continued to administer the shocks. The study was scandalous. If asked to do so by an authority figure, a majority of people will kill another human being completely unknown to them. It would be interesting to know if Professor Milgram advised the airlines on their security procedures. Would Mohammed Atta object to armed pilots? May 30, 2002. In a new safety initiative, the Department of Transportation has instituted an affirmative action program for Arabs interested in pursuing careers in aviation. Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta explained the security advantages of the program, saying, "Surrendering to discrimination makes us no different than the terrorists. Since you can't tell these days, this is not, in the strict sense, true." It is true that the department has prohibited pilots from carrying guns and has rejected the idea of a trusted traveler program. In fact, it's not doing anything to make the airlines any safer. This should come as no surprise, inasmuch as Mineta recently said he was unaware of any specific threat against aviation. They hate us. They're trying to kill us. They use airplanes as weapons. If Mineta doesn't read intelligence reports, can't he at least read the newspapers? In congressional testimony last week, Mineta mercifully spared the senators a recap of his experience in a Japanese internment camp and allowed his assistant, longtime Bush crony and ATF apologist John McGaw, to explain the department's key security improvements. The reason McGaw decided to prohibit pilots from having guns is, I quote, "They really need to be in control of that aircraft." This is literally the stupidest thing I've heard in my entire life. It is like saying women walking home late at night in dangerous neighborhoods shouldn't carry guns, or mace for my liberal friends, because they really need to be walking home. If the Undersecretary for Transportation Security thinks we have to debate whether pilots really need to be in control of that aircraft, someone other than him really needs to be in control of airline security. The scenario under which a pilot might need a gun is this. Islamic crazies have penetrated the locked cockpit, thwarting air marshals, passengers, and crew. It's going to be a little difficult for the pilot to be in control of that aircraft when he's fighting off an angry mob of sweaty Arabs. There is nothing that could go wrong at that point. A wounded passenger, a hole in the side of the plane, terrorists wresting control of the gun, that would be worse than the alternative. Ah, but McGaw is worried that the terrorists will now be in possession of a firearm. Think of the havoc they could wreak with a gun. Of course, they'll also be in possession of a Boeing 767, careering at 480 miles per hour toward the nearest landmark building. McGaw seems to think the real danger is that terrorists will shoot at the White House from the cockpit window, not that they'll fly the plane into it. McGaw is the worst kind of government bureaucrat. He defends fascistic government abuses, but the citizenry is no safer as a consequence. Fascism has its bad points, but at least trains are supposed to run on time. As the head of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, McGaw famously defended an unprovoked government assault against Randy Weaver and his family, culminating in the murder of Weaver's wife. In testimony before a Senate committee investigating the raid at Ruby Ridge, McGaw stubbornly refused to admit the ATF had done anything wrong. Indeed, he even refused to acknowledge a jury verdict finding that the government had entrapped Weaver. Of the jury's verdict, McGaw said, "Do you believe Randy Weaver, or do you believe the federal agents who have sworn to tell the truth and are carrying out a career in this government?" If only airline pilots worked for the ATF. Then McGaw would not only allow them to carry guns, he would also allow them to shoot law-abiding passengers at random. The Senate report found McGaw's testimony not credible and recommended abolition of his entire agency. McGaw's other airline safety improvement was to reject the idea of a trusted traveler program, which would allow passengers to avoid three-hour airport security lines in return for submitting to an intrusive background check. As reported by the New York Times, McGaw spurned the trusted traveler idea on the ground that he is not sure who could safely be given the card. I don't know. How about no Arabs? Religion of Peace update. As Pakistanis prepare to stone a rape victim to death, the latest suicide bombing in Israel claimed the lives of a grandmother and her 18-month-old granddaughter. Amazingly, President Bush has actually found someone even dumber than Norman Mineta to be Mineta's assistant. The Secretary of Transportation is the only person on the face of the globe who thinks the airlines face no terrorist threat, and his deputy, by his own admission, hasn't the first idea how to figure out which airline passengers can be trusted. If these guys were doing their jobs right, civil libertarians would be screaming bloody murder, Congress would be reining them in, and professional ethnic victims would be holding candlelight vigils and singing, "We shall overcome." Instead, Congress is forced to pass laws overruling Mineta and McGaw. Civil libertarians are scratching their heads, wondering why profiling is prohibited, and professional complainers are sending these guys flowers. Maybe somebody else should be doing this job. Postscript. On July 18, 2002, the Bush administration fired McGaw. On November 25, 2002, Bush signed legislation that would allow pilots to carry guns. Thank you for choosing United, Mr. Bin Laden. April 14, 2004. Last week, 9/11 Commissioner John Layman revealed that it was the policy before 9/11, and I believe remains the policy today, to fine airlines if they have more than two young Arab males in secondary questioning because that's discriminatory. Is 19 more than two? Why, yes, I believe it is. So, if two Jordanian cab drivers are searched before boarding a flight out of Newark, Osama bin Laden could then board that plane without being questioned. I'm no security expert, but I'm pretty sure this gives terrorists an opening for an attack. In a sane world, Layman's statement would have made headlines across the country the next day. But not one newspaper, magazine, or TV show has mentioned that it is official government policy to prohibit searching more than two Arabs per flight. Meanwhile, another 9/11 commissioner, the greasy Richard Benvenista, claimed to be outraged that the CIA did not immediately give intelligence on 9/11 hijackers Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Madar to the FBI. As we now know, or rather, I alone know, because I'm the only person in America watching the 9/11 hearings, Benvenista should have asked his fellow commissioner Jamie Gorelick about that. In his testimony this week, John Ashcroft explained that the FBI wasn't even told Almodar and Al-Hazmi were in the country until weeks before the 9/11 attack, because of Justice Department guidelines put into place in 1995. The famous 1995 guidelines were set forth in a classified memorandum written by the Deputy Attorney General at the time, Jamie Gorelick. The memo was titled Instructions for Separation of Certain Foreign Counterintelligence and Criminal Investigations, and it imposed a draconian wall between counterintelligence and criminal investigations. What Ashcroft said next was breathtaking. Prohibited from mounting a serious search for Almodar and Al-Hazmi, an irritated FBI investigator wrote to FBI headquarters, warning that someone would die because of these policies, since the biggest threat to us, OBL, Osama bin Laden, is getting the most protection. FBI headquarters responded, "We are all frustrated with this issue. These are the rules. NSLU, National Security Law Unit, does not make them up. But somebody did make these rules. Somebody built this wall." The person who built that wall, Ashcroft said, is a member of the commission. If this had been an episode of Matlock, the camera would have slowly panned away from Ashcroft's face at this point and then quickly jumped to an extreme close-up of Jamie Gorelick's horrified expression. Armed marshals would then escort the kicking, screaming Gorelick away in leg irons as the closing credits rolled. The 9/11 Commission has finally uncovered the proverbial smoking gun. But it was fired by one of the 9/11 commissioners. Maybe between happy reminiscences about the good old days of Ruby Ridge, Waco, and the Elian Gonzalez raid, Benvenista could ask Gorelick about those guidelines. Democrats think it's a conflict of interest for Justice Scalia to have his name in the same phone book as Dick Cheney. But there is no conflict of interest having Gorelick sit on a commission that should be investigating her. Bill O'Reilly's entire summary of Ashcroft's testimony was to accuse Ashcroft of throwing sheets over naked statues rather than fighting terrorism. No mention of the damning Gorelick memo. No one knows about the FAA's no-searching Arabs counterterrorism policy. Predictions that conservatives have finally broken through the wall of sound coming from the mainstream media may have been premature. When Democrats make an accusation against Republicans, newspaper headlines repeat the accusation as a fact. U.S. law chief failed to heed terror warnings. Bush was told of Qaeda steps pre-9/11, secret memo released. Bush White House said to have failed to make Al-Qaeda an early priority. But when Republicans make accusations against Democrats, even accusations backed up by the hard fact of a declassified Jamie Gorelick memo, the headlines note only that Republicans are making accusations. Ashcroft lays blame at Clinton's feet. Ashcroft, blame Bubba for 9/11. Ashcroft faults Clinton in 9/11 failures. It's amazing how consistent it is. A classic of the genre was the Chicago Tribune headline that managed to use both constructs in a single headline. Ashcroft ignored terrorism, panel told. Attorney General denies charges, blames Clinton. Why not? Reno ignored terrorism, panel told. Gorelick denies charges, blames Bush. Democrats actively created policies that were designed to hamstring terrorism investigations. The only rap against the Bush administration is that it failed to unravel the entire 9/11 terrorism plot based on a memo titled, Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States. I have news for liberals. Bin Laden is still determined to attack inside the United States. Could they please tell us when and where the next attack will be? Because unless we know that, it's going to be difficult to stop it if we can't search Arabs. Arab hijackers now eligible for pre-boarding. April 25, 2004. In June 2001, as Mohammed Atta completed his final to-do list before the 9/11 attacks, amend will to ban women from my funeral, leave extra little friskies out for Mr. Buttons, set TiVo for Streisand on Inside the Actors Studio. Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta was conducting a major study on whether airport security was improperly screening passengers based on ethnicity. As Mineta explained, "We must protect the civil rights of airline passengers. Protecting airline passengers from sudden death has never made it onto Mineta's radar screen." A few months later, 19 Muslim men hijacked U.S. airplanes and turned them into weapons of mass destruction on American soil. Suddenly, Mineta was a whirlwind of activity. On September 21st, as the remains of thousands of Americans lay smoldering at Ground Zero, Mineta fired off a letter to all U.S. airlines forbidding them from implementing the one security measure that would have prevented 9/11, subjecting Middle Eastern passengers to an added degree of pre-flight scrutiny. He sternly reminded the airlines that it was illegal to discriminate against passengers based on their race, color, national or ethnic origin, or religion. Mineta would have sent the letter even sooner, but he wanted to give the airlines enough time to count the number of their employees and customers who had just been murdered by Arab passengers. On September 27, 2001, the ACLU sent out a press release titled, "ACLU Applauds Sensible Scope of Bush Airport Security Plan," which narrowly won out over the headline, "Fox Approves Hen House Security Plan." As a rule of thumb, any security plan approved by the ACLU puts American lives at risk. Former ACLU Associate Director Barry Steinhardt praised Bush's Transportation Department for showing an admirable degree of restraint by not suggesting airport security procedures that would deny civil liberties as a condition of air travel. As usual, the ACLU had zeroed in on the true meaning of 9/11. Americans needed to be more tolerant of and sensitive toward ethnic minorities. Flush with praise from the ACLU, Mineta set to work suing airlines for removing passengers perceived to be of Arab, Middle Eastern, or Southeast Asian descent and/or Muslim. If we're going to start shifting money around based on who's rude to whom, my guess is Muslims are going to end up in the red. But that's not how Mineta's Department of Transportation sees it. Despite Mineta's clearly worded letter immediately after the 9/11 terrorist attacks and another follow-up letter in October, the Department of Transportation found that in the weeks after the 9/11 terrorist attacks carried out by Middle Eastern men, the airlines were targeting passengers who appeared to be Middle Eastern. To his horror, Mineta discovered that the airlines were using logic and deductive reasoning to safeguard their passengers, in direct violation of his just-issued guidelines on racial profiling. The Department of Transportation filed a complaint against United Airlines, claiming United removed passengers from flights in a few instances based on their race, color, national origin, religion, or ancestry. Mineta gave United no credit for so scrupulously ignoring ethnicity on September 11th that it lost 4 pilots, 12 flight attendants, and 84 passengers, not including the 9 Arab hijackers. In November 2003, United settled the case for $1.5 million. In another crucial anti-terrorism investigation undertaken by Norman Mineta, the Department of Transportation claimed that between September 11th, 2001, and December 31st, 2001, American Airlines, which lost 4 pilots, 13 flight attendants, and 129 passengers, not including 10 Arab hijackers, on September 11th by ignoring the ethnicity of its passengers, removed 10 individuals who appeared to be Middle Eastern from American Airlines flights as alleged security risks. On March 1st, 2004, American Airlines settled the case for $1.5 million. The Department of Transportation also charged Continental Airlines with discriminating against passengers who appeared to be Middle Eastern after the September 11th terrorist attacks. In April 2004, Continental Airlines settled the complaint for $500,000. Like many of you, I carefully reviewed the lawsuits against the airlines in order to determine which airlines had engaged in the most egregious discrimination so I could fly only those airlines. But oddly, Rather than bragging about the charges, the airlines heatedly denied discriminating against Middle Eastern passengers. What a wasted marketing opportunity. Imagine the great slogans the airlines could use. Now frisking all Arabs. Twice. More civil rights lawsuits brought by Arabs than any other airline. The friendly skies, unless you're an Arab. You are now free to move about the cabin. Not so fast, Mohammed. Worst of all, the Department of Transportation ordered the settlement money to be spent on civil rights programs to train airline staff to stop looking for terrorists, a practice known as digging your own grave and paying for the shovel. Airlines that have been the most vigilant against terrorism are forced by the government into re-education seminars to learn to suppress common sense. Airlines are being forced, at their own expense, to make commercial air travel more dangerous. Despite the deployment of 50,000 government-paid screeners since 9/11, it's still fairly easy to sneak knives, box cutters, and even guns onto most commercial flights. But there's good news, too. It's now virtually impossible to hijack a plane using an oversized carry-on bag or a set of nail clippers. Americans lull themselves into a sense of security by simply assuming the government is secretly screening airline passengers who look like the last 24 terrorists. No, it isn't. To the contrary, the government aggressively punishes airlines that have not abandoned rationality. The government fines airlines that give a secondary security check to more than 2 Arabs per flight. And Norman Mineta is busy suing airlines for millions of dollars if the airline removes passengers who share any physical characteristics with the people who recently killed 3,000 Americans using airplanes as their weapon. Also, Mineta is pushing to broaden the definition of on-time arrival to include planes that crash into buildings ahead of schedule. If any airline hijackings in the United States have been averted since 9/11, it is only because Attorney General John Ashcroft already has the terrorists in lockup. They're certainly not being stopped at the airport. Mineta doggedly insists that aviation security does not justify discrimination against passengers. Why not? The entire concept of security consists of a rational, experience-based process of discriminating between likely attackers and unlikely ones. If you could bring someone back in a time machine from pre-politically correct America, he would survey the situation after September 11 and say, "Well, you've got one advantage in this war with Al-Qaeda. At least you know what the enemy looks like. They're all Muslim men, so just work over those guys." Why is no one saying anything? Hello? Norman? Wow, you could hear a pin drop in this room. Not coincidentally, the only airline terrorist stopped since 9/11 was stopped by passengers. Fortunately, the passengers on an American Airlines Flight 63 from Paris were unburdened by Department of Transportation guidelines forbidding them to take Richard Reed's appearance into account. Not having been warned not to make judgments based on appearance, because that might send a message of inferiority to Muslims, the passengers were able to take one look at Reed and know he was trouble. They wrestled Reed to the ground just before he detonated a shoe bomb that would have blown up a plane with 185 passengers. An Australian newspaper titled its article on Reed, "Would you let this man board a plane?" Norman Mineta responded by ordering airport security to start checking all passengers' shoes. Even with hindsight, liberals can't see straight. May 5, 2004. Over in the alternative universe of the 9/11 Commission hearings watched only by me, Richard Benvenisto recently proposed an amazing new standard for investigating Arabs in this country. In the middle of haranguing Condoleezza Rice, Benvenisto demanded to know why the suspected 20th hijacker, Zacharias Moussaoui, had not been more aggressively investigated, despite the fact that, I quote, he had no explanation for the funds in his bank account and no explanation for why he was in the United States. So let me get this straight. Airport security can't acknowledge that a person is an Arab, but they should be allowed to audit his bank records? Come to think of it, can't explain his bank account or why he's here is also a pretty good description of John Kerry. Can we use that as a standard going forward? The government prohibits airlines from searching more than 2 Arabs per flight, so it would be terrific if liberals would let us examine their financial statements. If Democratic Party shills like Benvenista, who himself looks like someone who ought to be searched at airports, are going to make ludicrous, macho statements like that in order to win applause from weeping widows in the peanut gallery, can't we hold them to that policy when it matters? Benvenista thinks the key to stopping the 9/11 attack was for the FBI to have drawn the obvious conclusions from an Arab in flight school. If only the FBI had searched Massawi's computer, they would have found a flight simulator computer program, information about the Boeing 747, and extensive files on crop dusters. From this, apparently, Benvenista imagines the FBI would have concluded that on September 11th, 19 Muslims were going to hijack airplanes out of Logan, Newark, and Dulles airports and fly them into buildings. A somewhat more direct chain of causation traces its way back to the Aviation Security Commission, chaired by Vice President Al Gore in 1997. If that commission had done its job, you wouldn't have to wait for one of my columns to find out that there was a commission on airline safety years before the 9/11 attacks. Isn't it curious that Democrats aren't bragging about Gore inventing air safety? The reason Al Gore hasn't added anti-terrorism to the list of things he invented is that Gore's commission concluded that passenger profiling must ignore ethnicity and nationality. Or, as Gore himself might have put it, I took the initiative in making it easier for Muslims to use airplanes to slaughter innocent American citizens. The Gore Commission on Air Safety decided that profiling should be based on reasonable predictors of risk, not stereotypes or generalizations. Amazingly, all those reasonable predictors of risk failed to stop a single Muslim terrorist on 9/11. One wonders whether a profiling system that included ethnicity and nationality would have been more helpful in stopping 19 Muslim men, 15 of whom were from Saudi Arabia, all speaking Arabic to one another, from boarding planes on September 11th. Recently, that is, about the time Benvenista was shocked that the FBI hadn't uncovered the 9/11 plot based on the fact that Massawi had overstayed his visa, Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator Chuck Schumer were clamoring for the release of Ansar Mahmood, a 26-year-old Pakistani immigrant detained in October 2001 after he was observed taking photographs at a water treatment plant in upstate New York. Mahmood later pleaded guilty to committing a felony by giving financial aid to illegal immigrants from Pakistan. Schumer says Mahmood should be permitted to stay in the United States because he was cleared of terrorist links, and he has already served his time for a nonviolent felony. Hillary simply calls Mahmood's detention disturbing. Where is Benvenista when we need him? What happened to the "we don't know why he's here" or his sources of money standard for harassing Muslim immigrants? In contrast to Mahmood, Zacharias Massawi had committed no felonies. His only apparent offense was to have overstayed his visa. But Benvenista is appalled that the FBI didn't beat Massawi for information. The French had linked Massawi to al-Qaeda, based largely on the information that he took frequent trips to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Mahmoud's home country. When FBI agents in Minneapolis requested a warrant to search Massawi's computer, FBI headquarters wrote back, "We don't know he's a terrorist." The same argument Schumer is making for Mahmoud's release right now. Liberals always claim to know exactly what to do as soon as it's too late. After Muslims attack with airplanes, they want to investigate flight schools. After Muslims attack with shoe bombs, they want to investigate shoes. After a Muslim introduces E. coli into New York's water supply, liberals will be enraged that Muslim immigrants taking pictures of New York water treatment plants weren't investigated more aggressively, as soon as they are done blaming Bush for not stopping the attack. Liberals are the only known species whose powers of reasoning are not improved by the benefit of hindsight. Not only are they always fighting the last war, in most cases they're surrendering. Chapter 4. At least they didn't run Jimmy Carter this time. Inasmuch as John Kerry's campaign strategy is to hide until election day and let his many positions on every issue speak for themselves, there isn't a lot to say about the gigolo. Kerry wants to let people know what he stands for, but first he has to decide what he stands for. Just the other day, a reporter asked Kerry, "Are you for or against gay marriage?" As usual, his answer was, "Yes." So I'm including a few columns on the Democratic presidential candidates who are already appearing on Hollywood squares. The idea that there are any meaningful differences among the Democratic contenders is absurd anyway. They're all the same, except Dennis Kucinich. Only Kucinich could have held up a pie chart during a Democratic debate that was broadcast only on radio. Even more embarrassing, Al Sharpton asked the moderator what kind of pie it was. American women to Kerry. "We don't think you're so hot either." May 7, 2003. Senator John F. Kerry has been citing his valorous Vietnam record more often than General George Patton cursed. It's a good theme for him. Liberals keep loudly proclaiming that they support the troops, while simultaneously running sneering articles that portray the troops as coarse, semi-literate cads. So a tax-and-spend Massachusetts liberal like Kerry could finally provide them with one troop they really do like. By contrast, for the first time ever, I find myself in favor of the war, but against the troop. Kerry has been aggressively brandishing his military service with the bristling connotation that if you didn't fight, you can't quarrel with him on war and peace. In a catfight with former Vermont Governor Howard Dean during the Democrats' first presidential debate in South Carolina, Kerry snarled at Dean, "I don't need any lectures in courage from Howard Dean." If John Kerry had a dollar for every time he bragged about serving in Vietnam, oh wait, he does. Though Kerry makes liberal ladies' bosoms heave with his self-advertisements about his Vietnam experience, the Democrats might not want to let Kerry pursue this particular line of argument. According to Thomas Ricks's book, Making the Corps, the vast majority of officers currently serving in the military are conservative Republicans, largely comfortable with the views of Rush Limbaugh. Citing a series of studies expressing alarm at what they viewed as a disquieting trend, Ricks says that open identification with the Republican Party is becoming the norm. Even, suggests former Army Major Dana Isakoff, part of the implicit definition of being a member of the officer corps. Why the officer corps would take a dim view of a party that has spent the last 3 decades systematically trying to emasculate the military in pursuit of every conceivable social cause is anybody's guess. Still, there it is. So, by Kerry's own logic, in a few years, only right-wing Republicans will be eligible for the presidency. But that's the Democrats' problem. For now, there are other, more urgent implications to Kerry's argument. As long as we're going to get uppity about our personal experiences, why is John Kerry allowed to have any opinion about taxes? He has spent his entire life marrying a succession of heiresses and living off the fortunes amassed by other men. It must be the luck of the pseudo-Irish. How can Kerry claim to understand the anguish of people who pay high taxes? What does this pompous, whining, morally superior, mincing habitué of Boston drawing rooms know about confiscatory taxes on hard-earned money? Not that his nuptial path to wealth is not also hard-earned. If Kerry doesn't need lectures on the military from Howard Dean, do the rest of us need lectures from this sponge on how much we should be willing to pay in taxes? What is this male Anna Nicole Smith's expertise in average people paying taxes? I don't have a rich wife supporting me, and I don't look French. There was a firestorm of indignation when an unnamed Bush advisor recently remarked to the New York Times that Kerry looks French. Up until 5 minutes ago, the entire Kerry family used adjectives like European as statements of the highest praise. Carrie's sister cited her brother's cultured refinement in a 1994 profile of Carrie in Rhode Islander magazine by saying, "Our parents felt deeply that we needed to absorb the culture and know the Europeans as friends." In his 1996 Senate campaign, reporters were dazzled and awed when Carrie responded to a Canadian reporter in French, snootily noting that Carrie's French was much better than his opponent's. In a profile of Carrie's current heiress wife, Teresa Hines, in the June 2003 issue of Elle magazine, noted journalist Lisa DiPaolo quotes Carrie oozing with admiration for his wife, saying she is very earthy, sexy, European. Earthy and European sound like euphemisms for hairy armpits and body odor, but we get it. American girls aren't good enough for Frenchie. Well, we don't think he's so hot either. Even after Carrie was attacked for looking French, Hines thought the best course would be to defend her husband by haughtily snipping that the Bush aides probably don't even speak French. Take that, you boorish Americans. If the Democrats nominate Carrie, Bush should take the high road and pledge not to raise the issue of his opponent looking French. But the question of Carrie's fitness to discuss taxes while living off rich women is still on the table. General Democrat, October 1, 2003. According to a new survey, 6 out of 10 Americans can't name a single Democrat running for president. And that poll was actually taken among the 10 current Democratic candidates. According to the survey answers, the military guy leads with 19%, followed by that doctor, what's his name, with 12%, and the French-looking guy with 9%. Since Wesley Clark entered the race, Democrats have been salivating over the prospect of a presidential candidate who is a 4-star general and has the politics of Susan Sarandon. Clark's entry into the race was seen as a setback for John Kerry, the only other Democratic contender with combat experience, although back in the 1970s, Dennis Kucinich served in the KISS Army. Before Clark becomes the answer to a Trivial Pursuit question, consider that his main claim to fame is that he played a pivotal role in what most of his supporters passionately believe was an illegal, immoral war of American imperialism in Vietnam. How does that earn you points with Democrats? Clark said he would have supported the war in Iraq if he had been in Congress last year, but now he opposes the way the war is being fought and he wants U.S. troops out of Iraq as soon as possible. This was very exciting for Senator Joe Biden because for the first time ever he can now credibly accuse someone of plagiarizing him. Clark's other credential to lead the free world was that he supervised the liberation of Kosovo by ordering our pilots to drop bombs from 15,000 feet at a tremendous cost in innocent civilian life in a 100% humanitarian war against a country that posed absolutely no threat to the United States, imminent or otherwise, and without the approval of the almighty United Nations. So you can see why Clark supported, then opposed, then supported, then opposed the current war in Iraq. Say, is there a website where I can get up-to-the-minute updates on Wesley Clark's current position on the war in Iraq? Kind of like a NASDAQ ticker? Possible Clark campaign slogans are already starting to emerge. I was into quagmires before quagmires were cool. Honk if you got bombed in Kosovo. Only fired by the Pentagon once. The other Bush-bashing Rhodes Scholar from Arkansas. No, really, Vice President would be fine. On Meet the Press on June 15, 2003, Clark told Tim Russert that he got a lot of calls after 9/11 telling him to go on television and say, "This has to be connected to Saddam Hussein." Asked who had told him that, Clark said, "The White House. It came from people around the White House. It came from all over." But under cross-examination by Sean Hannity on the Fox News Channel a few weeks later, Clark would only say that he had gotten a call from a fellow in Canada who is part of a Middle Eastern think tank who gets inside intelligence information. So, in 2 weeks' time, Clark had gone from the White House to people close to the White House, to some guy in Canada. Clark is for abortion, tax hikes, affirmative action, and he is against the war in Iraq. But he served in Vietnam, so he's basically Howard Dean with scarier flashbacks. Howard Dean is not a general, but he is a doctor. Democrats are enthusiastic about Dean, since they figure that if this Democrat was ever caught with a naked intern, he could just say it was her annual physical. Dean has leapt beyond criticizing Bush and is now embracing terrorists. He has called Hamas terrorists soldiers in a war, and said the United States should not take sides between Israel and Palestinian suicide bombers. This has won him a spot in the hearts of the Democratic Party base, middle-class white kids from Ben and Jerryville who smash Starbucks windows whenever bankers come to town for a meeting. If Dean doesn't get the Democratic nomination, perhaps he could throw his hat into the ring to replace Arafat. The also-rans are trying to distinguish themselves by competing to see who can denounce George Bush with greater zeal. Senator John Kerry has said we need to de-Americanize the war, I guess on the theory that the de-Americanizing process has worked so well for the Democratic Party. He is furious at Bush for prosecuting a war Kerry voted for, saying the difference is I would have been patient. He would have had to be extremely patient in the case of Germany, inasmuch as Gerhard Schroeder announced before the war began that he would never authorize war in Iraq under any circumstances. Florida Senator Bob Graham recently told the Council on Foreign Relations that in answer to any questions about the Bush administration on the war on terror, the answer is no, they are not doing a good job. This would explain Graham's commanding lead among members of his own household, although his maid is still undecided. Dick Gephardt has taken to calling President Bush a miserable failure, as opposed to Gephardt, who is a happy failure. Things have gotten pretty bad when you're being called a failure by a guy who spent 30 years sucking up to labor but still can't get the AFL-CIO's endorsement. Dennis Kucinich recently proposed a new U.S. policy for Iraq, known in military circles as unconditional surrender. He wants all U.S. troops to leave immediately and be replaced by U.N. troops. The head of the U.N. Human Rights Commission, Syria, would surely have things back to normal in no time. Kucinich has also offered his services as a consultant to any city in Iraq that's thinking about filing for bankruptcy. According to most polls, the Democrat who stands the best chance to beat Bush is a guy named Generic. The Party of Ideas, November 20th, 2003. With economic growth and name recognition of the average Democratic presidential candidate both running at about 7%, the Democrats are in trouble. It turns out that given a choice between shock and awe and run and hide, the American people prefer the former. Unable to rouse more than the Saddam-supporting left with their kooky foreign policy ideas, the Democrats had been counting on a lousy economy. Now that the Bush tax cuts have already started to kick in and boost the economy, it was beginning to look as if the treason lobby would have nothing to run on. But the Democrats have discovered a surprise campaign issue. It turns out that several of them have had a death in the family. Not only that, but many Democrats have Cracker Barrel humble origin stories and a Jew or lesbian in the family. Dick Gephardt's campaign platform is that his father was a milkman, his son almost died, and his daughter is a lesbian. Vote for me. So don't say the Democrats aren't the party of ideas. As they keep reminding us, their ideas are just too darn complex to fit on a bumper sticker. Consequently, the Democrats can't tell us their ideas until after the election. Instead, their version of a political campaign is to stage a Queen for a Day extravaganza, which has special resonance in the case of the Democrats. Al Gore famously inaugurated the family tragedy routine at the 1992 Democratic National Convention, where his idea of an inspiring political speech was to recount the story of his son being hit by a car. At the 1996 convention, Gore told a tearjerker about his sister's long, painful death from lung cancer. It got to the point that Gore's family members had to fear any more runs for higher office. In the current campaign, Gephardt has taken to spinning out a long, pitiful tale of his son's near death 3 decades ago. At dozens of campaign stops, Mrs. Gephardt weeps anew as her husband tells the same gut-wrenching story over and over again. The relevance of their son's illness to Gephardt's run for the presidency is this. It inspired Gephardt's call for national health insurance. With his wife softly weeping in the background, he intones, "I get it." At least when Gephardt exploits a family tragedy, he doesn't expect praise for not exploiting a family tragedy. John Edwards injects his son's fatal car accident into his campaign by demanding that everyone notice how he refuses to inject his son's fatal car accident into his campaign. Edwards has talked about his son's death in a 1996 car accident, on Good Morning America, in dozens of profiles, and in his new book. It was and is the most important fact of my life. His 1998 Senate campaign ads featured film footage of Edwards at a learning lab he founded in honor of his son, titled The Wade Edwards Learning Lab. He wears his son's Outward Bound pin on his suit lapel. He was going to wear it on his sleeve until someone suggested that might be a little too on the nose. If you want points for not using your son's death politically, don't you have to take down all those "Ask me about my son's death in a horrific car accident" bumper stickers? Edwards is like a politician who keeps announcing that he will not use his opponent's criminal record for partisan political advantage. "I absolutely refuse to mention the name of my dearly beloved and recently departed son killed horribly in a car accident, which affected me deeply, to score cheap political points." I wouldn't want John Edwards to be president, but I think even Karl Rove would be willing to stipulate that the death of a son is a terrible thing. Howard Dean talks about his brother Charlie's murder at the hands of North Vietnamese communists. If a death in the family is the main qualification for becoming a Democratic presidential candidate, what's Scott Peterson waiting for? Bizarrely, after working on the failed George McGovern campaign, Charlie Dean went to Indochina in 1974 to witness the ravages of the war he had opposed. Not long after he arrived, the apparently ungrateful communists captured and killed him. "Hey, fellas, I'm on your side." Clunk. Howard Dean wears his brother's battered 1960s belt every day. By contrast, Ted Kennedy honors the memory of his deceased family members with several belts every day. Dean told Dan Rather about his brother's death at some length on CBS News. "It gave me a sense that you ought to live for the moment with people, that you really need to tell people you love them if you love them. It was certainly the most awful thing that ever happened to our family. It was terrible for my parents. It was even worse for them than it was for us. Damn it, if a man wants to be my president, I have a right to know where he stands on the issue of when to tell the people you love that you love them. Couldn't the Democratic Party go back to plagiarizing British Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock the way Senator Joe Biden did, rather than plagiarizing Lifetime TV for women? Do any men at all vote for the Democrats anymore?" Carol Mosley Braun's personal tragedy is that she's being forced to run for president, even though it turns out the Democrats won't need her to split the black vote anyway. "Please, can I drop out now? Al Sharpton is only polling at 2%. I hate this." Sharpton is the counterpoint to his sob sisters in the Democratic Party. Sharpton libeled innocent men in the Tawana Brawley case. He inflamed angry mobs in Brooklyn's Crown Heights, leading to the murder of Yankel Rosenbaum. He incited an anti-Semitic pogrom against a Jewish-owned clothing store in Harlem, Freddy's, ending in a blaze of bullets and a fire that left several employees dead. So while the other Democrats talk about their personal tragedies, Sharpton goes around creating personal tragedies. In addition to having a number of family deaths among them, the Democrats' other big idea, too nuanced for a bumper sticker, is that many of them have Jewish ancestry. There's Joe Lieberman, always Jewish. Wesley Clark, found out his father was Jewish in college. John Kerry, Jewish since he began presidential fundraising. Howard Dean, married to a Jew. Al Sharpton, circumcised. Even Hillary Clinton claimed to have unearthed some evidence that she was a Jew, along with the long-lost evidence that she was a Yankees fan. And that, boys and girls, is how the Jews survived thousands of years of persecution, by being susceptible to pandering. Clark said that when he discovered he was half-Jewish, he remembered growing up in Arkansas and feeling a certain kinship with Jewish families in the dry goods business. I, too, have always felt a certain kinship with Calvin Trillin. The Democrats' urge to assert a Jewish heritage is designed to disguise the fact that the Democrats would allow the State of Israel to perish as Palestinian suicide bombers slaughter Jewish women and children. Their humble origins claptrap is designed to disguise the fact that liberals think ordinary Americans are racist scum. Their perverse desire to discuss the deaths and near deaths of their children is designed to disguise the fact that they support the killing of more than a million unborn children every year. Oh, by the way, what did their milkman and mill worker fathers think about abortion? Be forewarned. If the Democrats start extolling you, get a gun. The Jesus Thing, January 7, 2004. When they were fundraising, the Democratic candidates for president all claimed to be Jewish. Now that they are headed for Super Tuesday down south, they've become Jesus freaks. Listening to Democrats talk about Jesus is a little like listening to them on national security. They don't seem terribly comfortable with either subject. To ease Democrats into the Jesus thing, the Democratic Leadership Council is actually holding briefings for Democratic candidates, teaching them how to talk about religion. As has been widely reported, the DLC gingerly suggests that Democrats start referring to God's green earth. The participants were also warned that millions of Americans worship a supreme being whose name is not Bill Clinton. Democrats never talk about believing in something. They talk about simulating belief in something. Americans believe in this crazy God crap that we don't, so how do we hoodwink them into thinking we believe in God? It's part of the casual contempt Democrats have for the views of normal people. What is arresting is the Democrats' fantastic habit of openly talking about how they plan to fake out the American people. The Democrats candidly say, "How do we make sure the Americans don't know what we're really thinking? Let's get a Southerner. Let's talk about Jesus. Let's talk about NASCAR. White Southern guys seem to like that. Let's see, if we could get a general on the ticket, Americans will forget how much we hate the military and long to see America humiliated." Never has a major political party talked so openly about their plans to fool the voters. It's the damnedest thing I've ever seen. They seem not to realize the people they are talking about are listening. In the current New Republic magazine, Peter Beinart points out that the capture of Saddam has hurt the anti-war cause and left the Democrats with nothing to say. He proposes that Democrats pretend to support the war on terrorism by calling for a massive campaign to catch Osama. Yeah, let's try that. That'll fool 'em. In the debate this week, John Kerry responded to a question about how he would appeal to Southerners by saying he could put a Southerner on his ticket. As Howard Dean has explained, they're stupid enough. It's just a bunch of white guys in pickup trucks with Confederate flags. Dean himself has recently made the fascinating discovery that a lot of Americans believe in God. Hold the phones. The Democrats have a soothsayer in their midst. Next, Dean will be announcing that he's just discovered how important this sex thing is. Before the poll numbers came out on religious belief in America, Dean said, "We have got to stop having our elections in the South based on race, guns, God, and gays. Higher taxes, gay marriage, abortion on demand, and surrender in Iraq, that'll do the trick in Mississippi." Then, about a month ago, the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press released a poll showing that people who regularly attend religious services supported Bush 63% to 37%, and those who never attend religious services opposed him 62% to 38%. When you exclude blacks, as they do in Vermont, who are overwhelmingly Baptist and overwhelmingly Democratic, and rerun the numbers, basically any white person who believes in God is a Republican. The only Democrats who go to church regularly are the ones who plan to run for president someday and are preparing in advance to fake a belief in God. Though Dean is pursuing the Jesus thing with a vengeance, the results so far have been mixed. In Iowa last week, Dean said, "Let's get into a little religion here," and then began denouncing Christian minister Jerry Falwell. "Don't you think Jerry Falwell reminds you a lot more of the Pharisees than he does of the teachings of Jesus?" I don't even know what Dean means by that. I am sure his audience doesn't. Rapping with reporters about God on the campaign plane, Dean said, "If you know much about the Bible, which I do," and then proceeded to confuse the Old Testament with the New Testament. Dean illiterately claimed his favorite book of the New Testament was the Book of Job. He said his least favorite was the Book of Numbers, and then explained how he planned to balance the budget. Having already complained to DNC Chairman Terry McAuliffe about other Democrats attacking him, Dean recently said, "I'm feeling a little more Job-like recently." That's comforting. A few snippy remarks from the likes of Dick Gephardt